Good evening and happy Black Friday. Welcome to the local news. Today is Friday, November 28th. I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, the National Weather Service in Eureka warns about increased risk of sneaker waves this weekend and next week. Humboldt Artisans will host their 45th annual Crafts and Music Festival at Redwood Acres in Eureka, and Ray Hamill with the sports report. Stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to this region.
The National Weather Service has put out a hazard warning today about an increased threat of sneaker waves in Costa del Norte, northern Humboldt Coast counties, southwestern Humboldt, and the Mendocino Coast over the weekend. According to the release, the impact of sneaker waves are, quote, large unexpected waves that can sweep across the beach without warning, sweeping people into the sea from rocks, jetties, and beaches. These sneaker waves can also move large objects such as logs, crushing anyone underneath. Don't be fooled by an ocean that looks calm. There can be 30 minutes of small waves before a sneaker wave strikes. Avoid steep beaches, stay much further back from the water, and never turn your back on the ocean. End quote. KMUD talked with Douglas Boucher, a meteorologist for the National Weather Services in Eureka. He explained the swell this weekend and warned that Monday there will be an even higher risk because of a low-pressure system called a hurricane force low that is located in the western Pacific.
We do have a risk for sneaker waves here Saturday afternoon. That's the first mid-period swell that arrives. Then we got a longer period, much more energetic wave group that arrives here late Sunday night into Monday, and that'll likely bring a higher risk for sneaker waves. A lot of our beaches, west and northwest facing beaches especially, that looks like to be a much higher risk because the wave periods are like in excess of 20 seconds. Generally with a storm that was near the international dateline. And so that wave group coming from a long distance. Whereas this swell that we're expecting on Saturday afternoon is more more of a Gulf of Alaska storm. It's more of a storm that's nearby. So the wave periods aren't quite as long. That's important because the longer the wave periods, the more likely the waves are going to, once they encounter shallow water, will begin to break. And what's exceptional about the wave event on Monday is that, or the swell event on Monday, or the sneaker wave risk on Monday is there'll be a longer interval between waves. And so you might not have a natural warning sign for, the beach being hazard or breaking waves, in the surf zone, as you might with, say, the waves are a lot bigger with shorter periods. So that's why we're putting out this beach hazard statement for the event on Saturday afternoon, and we'll probably need another one for Monday as well. So we're encouraging, we're telling people to, stay off. Don't be fooled by the ocean. That looks calm. It can be 30 minutes of small waves, very little wave activity before, larger sets or larger waves arrive. Avoid rocks and jetties, deep beaches, particularly like Centerville and then, and along the Lost Coast. There are more gentler sloping beaches like Clam Beach and Moonstone, but yeah, those beaches can also have water that surges up very suddenly. So if anyone is heading out to the beach, we're encouraging you to keep an eye on the water and be extra careful. Stay further back from the ocean, and especially don't go out on the jetties. Long period waves that are entering shallow water, and that could be the most dangerous time to actually be going out is right before the swell train arrives or right before the swell front arrives. It might look calm, or it might not look that hazardous, and you're looking at the jetty and there's no waves breaking over the jetty, and then swell front arrives and then all of a sudden it becomes very life threatening. So yeah, like I said, we're encouraging, we're telling people to be extra cautious here. Once on Saturday, and really that you could say any time you go out to the beach, but especially more so as on Saturday and then again on Monday, especially on Monday. But the thing is, I guess the holiday weekend, there might be more folks heading to the beach or heading to the shoreline this on Saturday because it's a long Thanksgiving weekend. And so that's another factor as well. Whereas on Monday, everyone's probably be going back to work. And so there might not be as many people, but, we're encouraging people to be extra careful even into Monday. And, unexpected waves, sneaker waves are generally, they're unexpected waves that can sweep across the beach without any warning. And that's the key right there. There's very little or no warning. And you don't want to get swept into that cold, frigid water because chances of survival are low.
For more information and updates, visit weather.gov/EKA/. Humboldt Artisans will be hosting their 45th annual Crafts and Music Festival from December 5th through December 7th. The event will be held at Redwood Acres in Eureka, featuring over 100 booths of handmade items from local and regional artists, 3 stages of live music, and food trucks. Admission is $5 or free with a gift to the Humboldt Bay Firefighters Toy Drive. Admission is also free for kids 5 and under and seniors 65 and older. The dates and times for this event will be Friday, December 5th from 4 p.m. to 9 p.m., Saturday, December 6th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., and Sunday, December 7th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Kema talked to Calista LeBoll, the events coordinator. She shared what to expect at the event and the variety of live music that will be at the event.
You enter and you can check out any of the 3 buildings. They're full of craft booths, and there's a stage in each building that will have a schedule of all the live music that's going to be happening throughout the weekend. And so the music is a kind of a variety of music, like local choirs, local jazz bands, solo folk artists, a great variety. And hopefully we'll have that kind of up on our social media and website at some point this week, too, so people can plan ahead for the different music acts they'd like to see.
The booths will include a giant variety of different handmade items that people can buy and also interact with local artists and vendors.
There are a huge variety of items that people make. There'll be people who have made ceramics, artists who have made like soaps and lotions, or things like yard art, glass artists, jewelry, ornaments, all sorts of things, like anything you could ever want. And art, you know, just art, functional art, as well as art to look at. It's going to be a huge variety. One of my favorite things is I like to get like a little, some different ceramics for like, I kind of collect my ceramic mugs each year. So I really enjoy that part, getting to buy myself a new pretty mug that's made by someone locally and has a lot of love and intention put into it.
LeBoll has been going to this event since she was born. Her mother was the coordinator before her, and she has been a part of this for almost 40 years.
I am 39 years old, and this is my 39th year being a part of the event because my mom was the coordinator before me, and I've grown up watching kind of this community of artists put this event together and make the event what it is. So it's really special for me to participate each year and see that. But as far as like the community importance, this is over 100 people who are making their livelihood, or they're making money for their fourth quarter here at our event, which they in turn will be spending in our community. And that's why it's so important to shop local, because when you do, it keeps it local. And events like these and other craft fairs, you get to participate in directly with the person who's made the product, rather than go through a middleman like you would at a store. And it's just really fun to be able to talk to people directly about the art that they're making and hear their inspiration behind it and just get to know better, like, kind of what Humboldt offers us as far as art. But yeah, I really do like to encourage people to shop local this holiday season, and our event is one of the best places you can do that.
The food vendors, according to LeBoll, will include Humboldt Bay Burgers, the Cafe Artist's Easy Squeeze Lemonade, and Fusion, and the Arcata Rotary Noon Club will be serving cocktails, beer, and wine. For more information on the event and music schedule, go to the Humboldt Artisans website, www.humboldtartisans.com, or follow their Facebook and Instagram, at Humboldt Artisans. Ray Hamill previews this weekend's North Coast Section Football Championship games, involving local teams with 3 Humboldt and Mendocino schools in action, as well as taking a look at all the big local sports stories of the week, including some college and high school basketball, why it was a big week for 2 local cross-country runners, and how the Cal Poly Humboldt women's soccer team fared in the NCAA playoffs.
Get ready for a big weekend in local high school football with 2 HCNL teams playing for a North Coast Section Championship along with one of the Mendocino County schools. Hello and welcome to this week's KMUD News Sports Report. I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com. We'll have more on the upcoming NCS Championship games in just a moment as we take a look at all of the big local sports stories of the week, including a look back at the section football semifinals, as well as some college and high school basketball, some cross-country country updates and how one local college team fared in the NCAA soccer playoffs. But first up, three local high schools will play for a North Coast Section Championship in football this weekend. In Division 5, the unbeaten Ferndale Wildcats face off against St. Vincent de Paul on Saturday night at Rancho Cotati High School in Rohnert Park, with kickoff set for 7 p.m. Earlier in the day, the Fortuna Huskies will play Bishop O'Dowd in the Division 6 decider at Moreau Catholic High School in Hayward. Kickoff for that game is set for 2 p.m. Also qualifying for an NCS championship game are the Ukiah Wildcats, who will play El Cerrito for the Division 3 championship at American Canyon High School on Friday night at 7. All three of the Humboldt and Mendocino County teams won their semifinals last weekend. The Wildcats, who are seeded number 2 in their bracket, broke open a close game against number 3 Salesian with a dominating fourth quarter and would win 35-7. The game was played at Coach Carlson Wildcat Field in Ferndale and was tied 7-7 late in the first half. Salesian had trouble moving the ball against a strong and physical Ferndale defense that has dominated its opponents all season long and came into the game having only given up 3 touchdowns all year. But a potent visiting aerial attack began to find its groove in the second quarter and would tie the game on a TD pass that capped a 95-yard drive. The setback, however, would prove to be just a minor one for the Wildcats, who took just 20 seconds to retake the lead on a 27-yard TD pass from quarterback Tanner Pigeon to Prescott Langer. After a scoreless third quarter, the Wildcats added 3 unanswered touchdowns in the fourth to pull away late. The Huskies also pulled away late in their semi-final at St. Bernard's on the way to winning 35-15. Senior Kavi Bolden scored a pair of touchdowns within a minute for Fortuna early in the fourth quarter, one on a 66-yard run on offense and one on a 30-yard pick-six on defense, as the visitors overcame a 15-13 deficit with 22 unanswered points. The loss ends the season for the Crusaders, who closed out 10-2, and were co-champs of the Big Four along with Fortuna. The Huskies, who have won 8 of their last 9 games and are 8-4, will now play for their first NCS championship since 2018, while the Wildcats will be playing for a second NCS title in 3 years and their 15th all-time. Their 14 section championships are the most ever by a public school. The Ukiah Wildcats, meanwhile, are seeded number 5 in the Division 3 tournament, and last week they knocked off number 1 Vintage 21-20 to reach the championship game. Ukiah has won a section title just once before, back in 1999. In local college basketball, meanwhile, new Cal Poly Humboldt men's head coach DJ Broom got his first win in charge of the team last weekend. The Jacks played a pair of road games in Rockland, including a double overtime thriller. One night after they defeated Northwest Nazarene by a score of 65-64, the Jacks got the better of Jessup University 85-81 in double overtime on Saturday. With the 2 wins, the Humboldt men improved to 2-2 on the season. The Cal Poly Humboldt women were also in action over the weekend, but lost 61-54 to Biola in La Mirada and dropped to 0-3. The College of the Redwoods teams were also in action over the weekend. The CR men reached the final of the Ed Boyle Invitational Tournament in Ukiah, but lost 75-66 to Foothill in Sunday's decider. With the loss, Redwoods dropped to 5-3. The Redwoods women had a tough weekend at the Sierra Tournament, losing all 3 of their games. CR fell 81-50 to Fresno on Thursday and followed that with a 66-59 loss to Sierra on Friday and a 90-58 loss to San Francisco on Saturday. The CR women, who are now 4-4, will play their home opener against Marin on Saturday at noon. In local high school boys basketball, the Fortuna Huskies got their first win of the season against Potter Valley on Tuesday, winning 73-26, while the Eureka Loggers tipped off their season with a 69-56 win over Hoopa, also on Tuesday. Switching gears, the HDNL schools headed to Hayward over the weekend for the NCS Cross Country Championships, with 2 local runners advancing to this weekend's state championships in Fresno. Fortuna sophomore Juan Ornales placed 12th overall in the Division 4 boys race, while Eureka Junior Ryder Bullman finished just one spot behind him in 13th. They will both make the trip to Fresno this weekend. HDNL champion Evan Poston of Arcata competed in the NCS Division 3 race and finished 27th overall. The Arcata boys placed 10th as a team. In girls cross-country action, two-time HDNL champion Claire Gast of Eureka finished 34th overall in the NCS Division 4 race. As a team, Fortuna led the way and finished 11th in Division 4, followed by Eureka in 12th. And rounding out a busy week in local sports, the Cal Poly Humboldt women's memorable season on the soccer fields came to an end in the opening round of the NCAA Division II West Region Tournament. The Lumberjacks qualified for the NCAA playoffs after a thrilling run through the California Collegiate Athletic Association Tournament that saw them crowned tourney champs. But they would lose 1-0 in a rematch with defending national champs Cal Poly Pomona in the opening round of the NCAA Tournament last weekend. And that's this week's KMUD News Sports Report. Until next time, I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com.
In state news, California Report calls for expanding youth apprenticeship pathways. Public News Service's Suzanne Potter reports.
A new statewide report says California could dramatically scale up youth apprenticeship programs to strengthen the workforce and close persistent skill gaps. Labor educators in Southern California say the findings reflect what they see daily. Young people need earlier access to hands-on training and clearer pathways to good jobs. The California Youth Apprenticeship Committee report recommends creating more bridges from high school to registered apprenticeship programs, expanding college-connected pathways, and ensuring supportive services for those who are out of school. David Espinosa, who heads the Laborers Training School in Azusa, says these programs give young people a practical on-ramp to careers that otherwise feel out of reach.
Apprenticeships are extremely important for the simple purpose of opportunity. Typically, most people aren't born with that skill set. There's a lot of things to learn, from safety to actually unique skills associated with those different types of work projects.
The report notes 32% of California apprentices are between ages 16 and 24 and estimates the state could grow to serve up to 650,000 apprentices overall. The recommendations align with Governor Gavin Newsom's workforce strategy to expand on non-degree career pathways. Training staff say the need is about more than filling job openings. It's about making sure young people enter the field confident and prepared. James Smith, a longtime instructor and now training manager at the Laborers Training School, says students benefit from using real tools and techniques long before they arrive on a job site.
It was great practice for them. They actually learned something they could take right to the field. The bosses recognized them, and our main thing is about safety.
For students nearing completion, the pathway feels transformative. Construction apprentice Linnell McTeer, finishing his final class, says the program has opened doors he never had before.
You have a career to lean on. Ultimately, you're making a lot of money. It's just a great opportunity and a good experience for somebody who doesn't mind working with their hands or being physically in the field.
The report urges the state to invest in early career exposure programs, supportive services, and regional intermediaries to help more young people on apprenticeship pathways, especially women, foster youth, and formerly incarcerated people. Labor educators say expanding capacity now will be essential to meeting California's future workforce needs. For California News Service, I'm Farah Siddiqui. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In national news, Tipping Point report describes rapid surge in poverty, likely to worsen due to big, beautiful bill cuts. KPFA's Kennedy Quello reports.
The report says the rate of poverty between 2011 and 2021 decreased steadily to only 10% in 2021. But the report says poverty began increasing quickly since 2021. It rose to 16% by the end of 2023. That comes out to over 1 million people. The report says this does not include the nearly 800,000 people who live near poverty, which has increased as well. Sam Cobbs is the CEO of Tipping Point. He talked about the report's findings at a media briefing.
That is now back to 2016 levels. This is one of the fastest regional increases in recent history. And that means that during that period of time, a staggering 245,000 people fell into poverty during that short time. And to give you an idea of the scale of that problem, that nationally that is the size of Boise, Idaho, or locally, the entire population of Marin County.
Allie Sutton is Chief Program Officer at Tipping Point Community. She says part of the reason for the surge in poverty is the continual increase in the cost of housing in the region. The organization blames part of that on the boom in the artificial intelligence industry. Sutton also anticipates worsening conditions as the effects of President Trump's Big Beautiful Bill start to be felt through deep cuts to many social services programs.
Given those substantial cuts, we anticipate these numbers will only worsen over the next few years, deepening poverty across the Bay Area. Our report shows that safety net programs keep more than 176,000 people out of poverty in 2023. And even that was with the diminished federal support post-COVID. Without these programs, the poverty rate would have topped 19%. If we fail to preserve the basic supports that keep people housed and fed, the impact will be truly devastating.
Sam Cobbs then discussed ways to reduce poverty rates. First, he discussed funding local organizations to aid low-income students in graduating college. Though having a degree did not keep people out of poverty, the data in the report shows that those with a degree did not fall into poverty at as fast a rate as those without one. Cobbs also said it is important to fund solutions that are shown to prevent poverty, such as job training programs, to prepare people for what he called the new economy around AI.
Not only is AI coming, but is actually already here. And from what I understand, it's supposed to create jobs, create more jobs than will be displaced. But people have to be trained and ready to enter into that job force. And so really focusing in on the things that we know prevent poverty and doing it in an increased way with our investment and funding more of the things that we have done and also looking to fund new innovations around preventing and solving poverty.
Cobb said Tipping Point pledges to double their investments in Bay Area communities from $500 million to $1 billion over the next 10 years. Tipping Point is funded by individuals and charitable foundations. It was founded by current San Francisco Mayor Daniel Lurie in 2005. Lurie left the organization in 2023. For KPFA News, I'm Kennedy Cuello.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A month after the devastating Western Alaska storm, hundreds of evacuees are still sheltering in hotels in Anchorage. This week, some received a delivery of subsistence food donations, a small taste of home, during the holiday season. Ayolna Nyden with the Alaska Desk has this story.
Stephanie Anever answers the door to her hotel room. A volunteer hands her a bag filled with traditional foods.
Oh, it's fish, salmon, and some strips.
Anever was living in Kipnik when the remnants of Typhoon Halon destroyed her home. She's one of more than 600 displaced people staying in Anchorage hotels. The storm also devastated traditional harvests.
Left us with nothing.
Anever says she's thankful to receive the subsistence food donations.
It's good to have a native food subsistence to share with my family. Yes, yes.
Alaska Native Heritage Center and other local organizations have been gathering subsistence food donations for over a month, and they have been distributing them to evacuees. Veronica Berger is a program manager at the Heritage Center. She says they have delivered to about 250 rooms in hotels across Anchorage.
They lost a lot of their harvests, their gatherings, so it's helped get a little taste of home.
Berger says the Heritage Center staff try to be mindful of the conditions people have in hotels and deliver food that they can actually use. She says they have two types of donation bags. The one for hotels with kitchens includes items like fish fillets and moose meat cuts. And evacuees who don't have kitchens receive a bag with items they don't have to cook, like muktuk and herring eggs.
Anything that they can eat raw, I guess.
For Elizabeth Smith from Kipnik, the most exciting item in the food bag was
herring eggs, but I need oil.
Smith says she usually adds seal oil to herring eggs, so she wishes the donation bag included that. For now, she says she will keep the food donations in her mini fridge,
My family's over at the Aspen. I might go see them. I might share them this.
In addition to delivering food to hotels, the Heritage Center also hosted potlucks and is planning more events in the months to come. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naidin.
A new report highlights the high levels of childhood trauma among juveniles who are tried as adults. Juvenile justice advocates are seeking reforms that consider these experiences before, during, and after interactions with the court system. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
The research from Human Rights for Kids show of the more than 2,200 incarcerated people surveyed, greater than 80% experienced four or more adverse childhood experiences, a rate far higher than the general population. In a recent webinar, report co-author Aiden Leslie explained many respondents endured severe abuse beginning around age six, had been trafficked or exploited, or had committed offenses linked directly to their abuse. He says almost none had their trauma taken into account by judges during their sentencing.
Once children end up in the adult justice system, they face a level of repression and victimization that only serves to compound the trauma they've already experienced, while failing to actually address that trauma. The justice system itself also tends to serve as an extremely intimidating and traumatic experience.
Leslie says some of the profound developmental impacts of trauma include higher rates of mental health conditions among youth in the system, with especially severe experiences for girls and Native American children. I'm Judith Ruiz Branch reporting.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One. The Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Dennis Moore, and thanks to our reporters, Ray Hamill, Susan Potter, Kennedy Quello, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.